Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 31.
Trentuno.
So we've got a deal for our listeners.
We do?
We do. We're going to give you extra podcast episodes next week in exchange for some Kickstarter support.
Oh, yeah. We really need all of our listeners who enjoy this show to support us on the Kickstarter.
As you've heard, we're on episode 31. We've done various guest interviews, and if you've been enjoying them, please go check out our virtual reality Kickstarter and back us, support us. It's a really, really cool project.
You can find it going to hideawaycircus.com or our Facebook page. And I think we've been surprised at how many people don't know virtual reality.
Yeah.
Which is something I didn't consider.
Yeah, it wasn't until I was talking to Michelle Levy did she say, oh yeah, you have a tough spot because you have to sell not only the experience, but also what the technology is.
Right, well, because I was talking to someone and he was like, so do you sit all, so when you finish it, are you all going to sit, do we all get to sit in a movie theater together and watch it? And I was like, no, that's not how virtual reality works.
You sit on your couch.
You could theoretically all sit in a movie theater and watch it through your own VR headset. That is something you definitely could do, but that's not how it's used or not how we want it to be used, because we want it to be accessible to people all over the world at all different times.
In the comfort of home.
Yeah.
And for those of you who didn't listen to the last episode or are tuning in because you're interested about Barry, Lindsay and I are kickstarting a new circus dance virtual reality project where we're going to be in Australia because our show Slumber is in Australia, and we're going to shoot 5 of the best circus acts in the world with a 360 camera in stunning outdoor Australian and a few American locations, and edit it together and make a really, really cool circus show designed specifically for virtual reality. You can learn more about it at our Kickstarter. Like Lindsay mentioned, it's on our website and Facebook and in the description mm-hmm. of the podcast. But if you enjoy this episode, if you've been enjoying listening, please go consider backing us. Check out our video. We put a new one up today where we went to the Muse in Brooklyn, which is where mm-hmm. we rehearsed Slumber.
It's cool because you can see some people like practicing trapeze and hand-to-hand and rope and silks and straps. And basically every discipline.
Yeah, it's the premier circus training space in Brooklyn. So if you're kind of curious what that looks like, just take a look at the video mm-hmm. and Lindsay and I talk about the project a little bit more in that one too.
Yeah. Also, something we talked about last week that we kind of didn't mention was a little snippet about the Paramore.
Well, we didn't mention it because the news came out like an hour after we released right. the episode.
And it all makes sense now. So Paramore, Cirque du Soleil's show on Broadway, is closing in April after a year of being open.
Exactly
1 year of being open, because the new Harry Potter show is going into that theater. And Josh and I were like, oh, that's strange that, you know, they're saying that they're renovating the theater and going to try to find another one, blah, blah. But
yeah, you can hear us musing about it for 5 minutes on the previous episode.
But we found out that that the Ambassador Theater Group, the people that own the Lyric that Paramore is currently playing in, are paying Cirque du Soleil $20 million to close the show so they can renovate it for Harry Potter.
And the show costs Cirque du Soleil publicly $25 million. Of course, what the real costs are, only Cirque knows, but that basically sounds like they
made out like bandits. No show gets that opportunity. And leave it to Cirque.
It just took to basically recoup in less than a year while still being kicked out of their theater.
Like, good for them.
Yeah.
You know?
Way to pull that business move, Cirque du Soleil.
I know. It's so funny. It's so funny. But I'm so excited for Harry Potter.
Speaking of shows that are opening this spring, Spiegelworld just announced they're opening Absinthe in L.A. starting, I believe, March 22nd.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
And for those of you who haven't seen Absinthe, it's a really awesome variety show. They opened it in New York originally, I believe in 2006, and it played here a few times and then has been a mainstay in Las Vegas for at least 4 or 5 years now. It consistently wins Best Show in Vegas. So if you're going to be in LA, it's playing at the Staples Center, so go
check it out. Good opportunity to go see some good variety
stuff. It is.
I'll tell all my friends.
Why did you just get all grumpy and dark?
I didn't.
Some good,
well, I was actually trying not to burp.
Oh.
And then I just did. So
should we keep this section in?
I don't care. Burping is a bodily function that everyone does. So
true that.
True. Oh, I went to my first Bindle Stiff variety show Open night variety. And I talk about brain tickles a lot. And brain tickles are something when it gives you immense pleasure that your brain feels like it's tickling because you're watching something that is just so delightful. And I had brain tickles the whole way through the Bindle Stiff.
What did you like the most?
I liked the, like, I don't give a bleep attitude of the whole thing. It was like, I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to try what I want.
Which act did you like the most?
Oh, I thought you meant like the overall arc of the show. Oh, God, Adam Kukler.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so great. So Adam Kukler is a juggler and clown and cigar. I mean, well, I guess Cigar Box is juggling, but he's just a great performer.
Multi-talented.
And he was trying a new act that night.
A hats act.
A hat juggling act. And I, like, had teary eyes. I was so emotionally struck by his act. It's the first time I saw a juggling act that really has, like, affected me emotionally and not gratuitously. Like, the way in which he used the hat as, like, this person that he was clearly thinking about, but then also it was like, this, oh, it's just a hat. You know, it was so good.
It's always amazing when you see an act elevate like that. Like, I have a few moments in my mind where at certain points I saw somebody on a discipline do something which just, I was like, wow, that is next level. And the two that come to mind immediately are, I saw Eric Bates when he was still at circus school do a cigar box act for a special event in New Hampshire that I believe Shea Vaccaro or Josh Shack organized. Sorry for those of you who don't know those names. Those are all people who are involved in Smirkus. Eric Bates is a cigar box juggler. But he did it as like a kid, like playing with his toys, and that really blew my mind. And then later on I saw this performer, Andrew Adams, do a straps act with an umbrella, which again, just, you see it rarely, but I definitely think Adam Kukler was one of those where you see the number and you're like, wow, I've never seen that kind of discipline move me emotionally in that kind of way.
It was so good. It was so good. And I loved watching Keith do his little like bits between. That was my other favorite part, was Keith.
I
had never seen Keith actually perform. Just seen him and met him. And I just loved when he would do something and look at the audience. It was just like such a showman.
I also just like that Keith did a whole Diablo act where he didn't drop once. It's refreshing to see some dropless juggling.
It was great.
I also wanted to mention, if you're interested in working the Bindle Stiffs, Keith and Stephanie are casting for a male acrobat for their 2-week run of a cardboard and duct tape spectacular. They're looking for men who have 2 ground acts and strong ensemble experience. So ideally you're an acrobat, a hand balancer, an equilibrist. I think that means like somebody who balances on things. And a ground act. The show's going to run May 1st to May 14th. If you're interested in running away with the Bindle Stiffs, shoot an email over to keith@bindlestiff.org.
I think we should start doing more casting announcements on the podcast. Yeah, so if you have any other casting that you want us to talk about, email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Today on the podcast, we interviewed Barry Lubin, who some of you might also know as Grandma. And it was cool for me to interview him because I grew up seeing him in the Big Apple Circus as Grandma, the clown.
Yeah, I met Barry actually when I was 15 or 16. He came and spoke at Smirkus. And it was a very like moving moment for me when I got to sort of see the man behind the wig and the red dress. But it's a really fun interview where Barry sort of recaps his career starting off in New Jersey and being an aspiring television director and going through Ringling Clown College and working with Ringling and his 25 years at Big Apple Circus and what he's doing now, which includes a really interesting project where he's headed to Antarctica.
Yes. And I think he says something really interesting that you'll hear in the interview about the idea of failing and failing throughout your career continuously. And that it's not just a one-time thing that you fail and then you figure it out and you don't fail again. And, I think it's like important to remember, especially with like all of this social media where everyone posts stuff that makes it looked like they're continually achieving and doing amazing things and can always happy, you know? And I just think it's important to remember the like true moments of like failure and disappointment. And then like going back, and Gypsy talked about it. Gypsy Snyder, when we interviewed her on our podcast, talked about the importance of failure as well. But I liked hearing it from a very
clown. Yeah. It's fun. Cause also like he tells, I don't want to get too much away, but he tells the story of when he performed at, the big Monte Carlo circus festival and sort of how high the stakes were in that and the failure he experienced in part of that process. But I'll leave it to you guys to listen to that.
It was a really fun interview, so enjoy listening to Barry Lubin.
So did you see any circuses growing up as a kid?
My earliest memory of a circus was going to an outdoor circus and getting splinters in my ass. Not remembering anything else about it except that the bleachers were absolutely horrible, and that's my entire memory of going to a circus. I grew up in Atlantic City in that area, and there was a place called Steel Pier. A lot of people know what that is, but a lot of people younger do not know what that is. But it was a really amazing entertainment complex, and at the very end of the pier, which is about a half mile out to sea, the star of the show was the world famous diving horse. But before that, there were circus acts and there were clowns. There were basically incredible divers who in the summer were in Atlantic City and in the winter were diving in Acapulco. And in the first part of the show, they did incredible dives. And in the second part, they were clowns. And that was kind of my first experience with circus acts and with clowning live.
Did you go to regular high school or did you go to performing arts high school or did you do theater when you were younger?
I did, but I grew up very conservatively, and I'm sure my parents never gave me any encouragement to go into show business. What I did want to do when I grew up was become a TV director, and I did go to college for that, and obviously that worked out.
You went to Emerson first, right?
Say that again?
You went to Emerson College first, right?
I did go to Emerson College to become a TV director, and I changed my major a few times and dropped out after 3 years. But I intended to go back after taking a year off and trying to figure out what I really wanted to do with my life because I was relatively lost. And it was during that year that I took off that I met a guy who'd gone to the Ringling Clown College. And he said, well, the circus is coming to the Boston Garden. Why don't you see if they have an audition? And, you know, it's kind of cool. And it was something that I had never dreamt of doing in my entire life. I was not a fan of the circus. but it sounded better than what I was doing because as a college dropout, I was a bill collector. I actually called people on the phone and asked them to pay their electric bill, their phone bills, their doctor bills, hospital bills, all day long.
Oof.
One of the great and true stories here is my own phone bill went into arrears and they turned off my phone. And at the time I was collecting, they did it by letters. I was collecting the M's, all the M clients. And I switched with somebody who had the L's and my own phone bill came in after 90 days in arrears, and I paid it and made the commission on it. But I lasted 1 year at that, and that certainly wasn't something that I wanted to do, but I didn't end up going back to Emerson. I actually auditioned and got into Clown College, and the rest is kind of history.
What was your audition for Clown College like?
I was paired up with one other person, auditionee, and a veteran clown, and a big part of it and a big influence on me was that this guy really opened up about what the circus really meant to him, like from the heart. And he talked about the life and he talked about the job, but he talked about the spiritual nature of the thing that I was, you know, possibly interested in pursuing. And it was very it was contagious, his attitude and his love for the circus. The actual physical audition I recall, was doing a pantomime of a tightrope walk. And I do recall that the dean of Clown College, Bill Ballantyne, really was, he seemed very interested in me and he made some real eye contact with me. And we had this moment where I felt like I might just get into this clown college thing. I wasn't sure I wanted to, but it did sound better than being a bill collector.
Can you talk about what the program was? Because it changed before a little bit before it closed. So what was it like when you went through it?
It was morning, noon, and night. You learned every possible aspect, but in only 8 weeks' time. I think there were 48 people in my class, including the amazing Bill Irwin. And we essentially did juggling and stilt walking and acrobatics and trampoline and wire and elephant riding. We had an elephant riding class, and they basically killed us for the day. And at night after dinner, we came back and watched silent movie classics. So a lot of people fell asleep, including me. But part of my story is when I was young, my father rented out a movie theater in one of the old hotels in Atlantic City and showed silent movies. And nobody came, but I went with him every night and helped him rewind film in the projection booth and watched the classics night after night for 2 summers. And not realizing what it was going to mean to me, I was absolutely fascinated by it. And I wanted to be up there on the screen. I absolutely did, but didn't really pursue it. As I said, I went to college to become a technical person in the business. So essentially I could sleep through all the movies at night because I knew them backwards and forwards. And it was a very interesting experience. In 8 weeks, you're inundated with this, and some of the great masters were taken off the road and taught us at Clown College. And I found myself getting more and more sucked into it. I really wasn't interested at the beginning. I was fascinated, but not, you know, really thinking this was for me. And I just got more and more into it. And by the end, I wanted it. I really felt like this could be cool, but a temporary cool, not necessarily something that would lead to what it did lead to.
Were you offered a job when it finished?
I was offered a job. I ended up on the red unit of Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. And I think there were 11 new clowns there. And this is where I was given a real gift by the producers, Irvin and Kenneth Feld. On the first day of performance, I tried this character, this little old lady character. And it didn't get laughs, but it got a hell of a lot of attention because the first performance was in Venice, Florida. And Venice was populated by an awful lot of people that looked exactly like Grandma. And people were pointing at me. I was getting a lot of attention because they were worried that one of them had accidentally walked down and was on the hippodrome track and in the ring and was in severe danger. And so I got a lot of attention immediately. It was one of many characters that I tried, but it was the one that the audience really seemed to want more of. So the gift I was talking about was I was encouraged by the producers to improvise and find this character. And for a half an hour before every show, and we're talking 600 shows my first season, I just went up and played with this character and improvised with the audience and just kind of learned who this character is. And that gift, you know, came in extremely handy. All the small things that I developed in the seats on Ringling, when I was able to do the One Ring Circus, Big Apple Circus, those little things translated really well because of the focus that you had on Big Apple Circus.
I don't know if you'll remember this, but in 2007, you visited Circus Mercus, and I was 17 or 18. And Troy was sort of asking you to talk about the importance of playing in the round, because that was something the troopers were struggling with during creation. And you told this sort of great story about how you would go into the nosebleed seats and sort of work the crowd during pre-show up there, and then you'd get a greater reaction from them when the show is happening. I wonder if you can sort of talk about that experience and sort of what you were thinking about that at the time.
Well, it was evil, because what I was essentially doing was stealing focus from, you know, an entire three-ring circus. As you said, I went up in the audience during pre-show, and what I said to these people in the worst seats in the house, I said, when you see me during the show, and I may be all the way across the arena, as far away as possible, when you see me wave, just cheer as loud as you possibly can. So I would make my first appearance, and I would wave and get this enormous cheer. So what would happen is the entire cast would look up into that section and wonder what was happening. The entire audience, which was anywhere from, you know, 5 to 10 to sometimes 20,000 people, were also looking over there and then looking down on the hippodrome tracker in the rings to find out, well, what the hell just happened that got that reaction. And by that point, of course, I innocently was on my way doing whatever it was I was doing. But that boy, was that fun.
What was the idea behind Grandma? Because I guess you did it in the first performance, but did you have an idea of like, oh, I want to try this character who is an older woman, or what was it?
First idea was to do a little old man. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Laugh-In was a very, very big TV show. And there was a guy named Artie Johnson doing a dirty little old man. And I thought inevitably the audience and my fellow clowns would say, oh, he's doing Artie Johnson. And I didn't want that. So I said, okay, I'll try a little old lady character. The first wig was a non-wig because I had a Jewish afro at the time, and I used to baby powder my entire head, which is a terrible idea. Sorry, I'm going to turn off all my media. I was told in clown college that you should really design your costume. You should really know how to sew it yourself, design it, sew it, maintain it. Don't be a Goodwill clown. So the first opportunity I had in my first professional job in winter quarters, I went immediately to the Goodwill and I bought what is essentially the prototype look for Grandma. And I still basically look very, very close to that. The original look was a coat. But when I started working in tented circuses like the Royal Hannaford Circus and Big Apple Circus, it's terribly impractical because you're sweating to death in the summer in a winter coat. But that winter coat inspiration was from my trips to Miami Beach when I was in high school, and I would see these senior citizens all wrapped up and with scarves and winter coats, and it was 85 degrees out. And I thought, well, this is really interesting. And so that was the original idea for that. Now, I was not actorly in any way, though I did a little bit of acting at Emerson and in high school. I still will look at a script, whether it's a film script or a theatrical script, and not know what the hell to do with it. And thank God there are people out there that can tell me what to do. But I wanted to be improvisational. And part of that, and this is so odd to some people, if you know the comedian Lenny Bruce, he used to improvise something like 70% of his act. And I would read his, you know, about his life, and I would go, I want that. I want to be that clown who can just continuously improvise. I'll have a few things that I do, but hopefully I'll be able to build on these improvisations. And the fact is, I was not able to develop any actual consistent material this way, but I did improvise for a very long time, a number of shows before I found anything that was consistently funny that I could actually count on a high percentage of the time. But I realized early on also that this was not an acting job. This was a clown job. This was not a person trying to be true to what a senior citizen would be like. This was me trying to get laughs, period. It's still what I do. I will give up realism for, you know, what a little old lady might do in real life in favor of, well, that got a laugh, it stays in, I don't care. I know you're supposed to kill your darlings at some point if it doesn't really work with theme or a show, but I have lived and died with that theory, and I still, you know, go by it. I like to say, and I'm getting a little off subject, but I like to say that I'm not the interesting clown, to be honest. I won't be the person who will carry a theme nor the person who will tell a story or open up his or her heart and really, you know, connect with the audience directly in that manner. I'm the one who will do a headstand on a whoopee cushion to make you laugh, and that is my connection to humanity. Just simply the fact that I want you to escape from whatever your pain is of the day or the week or the year, and just have fun for that little period of time that we're together.
How long were you with Ringling for, and what happened afterwards?
I was on the red unit of Ringling for 3 years, the end of which I was invited to perform very prematurely at the International Circus Festival of Monte Carlo, completely unequipped, inexperienced, had no knowledge of what it was like to work in a one-ring circus.
Is that your first time performing in a tent?
Pardon me?
Was that your first time performing in a tent at that festival?
Yes, it was. It absolutely was. And I basically knew nothing, and I basically died 1,000 deaths. And that was the end of my third year in clowning. It was so absolutely terrible that I really was pretty sure it couldn't get any worse than that. Because at that turning point, it's essentially the Academy Awards of circus. It's the penultimate moment in your career. And here I am, completely inexperienced, going to this festival and failing miserably. I realized, okay, the sun came up the next day. It was painful as hell to fail day in and day out and not win any. We didn't deserve to win any prizes. My partner, Jimmy Tinsman, and I went as a team, and I did some solo work, and so did he. But I realized, okay, that's probably as bad as it's going to get. Cary Grant's in the audience. Princess Grace is in the audience. And the biggest producers, directors, and owners of circus in the entire world are gathered to watch me die 1,000 deaths. The ironic part of this story is CBS with the Felds, who own Ringling, made a deal with the Prince to telecast on CBS the highlights of the International Circus Festival of Monte Carlo, and they added a laugh track. So I was on for 30 seconds, and they added a laugh track, and I got calls from all over the United States congratulating me on my success at the festival in Monte Carlo. It was crickets. I mean, it was a complete zero. A basic mistake, and we made hundreds of basic mistakes. At the end of every act, you would have the band play your music in a march. And essentially, no matter how bad you were or how good you were, the audience would clap you off rhythmically. We had no idea, so we went off to dead silence. And my partner and I went behind the curtain, and we just fell over laughing because it was either laugh or cry. It was so phenomenally big a failure.
That must have been so great for your future writing material, because once you've experienced bombing like that under those circumstances, like, what's scary anymore, really, being on stage?
I wish to God that made me immune from pain and fear. I would just say that the realization that the sun came up the next day and nobody died because I failed, you know, that's certainly comforting in a way, and allows you to continue. But I've had some phenomenal failures. They don't go away, and to this day I still have them. And I think there's an expectation that I never have them, so that when I teach, I often talk about my continued failures and how important it is to take risks and try new material. With that, as you know, comes the possibility that it's going to suck. And when new people hear somebody like me say that, I think it's really instructional and really helpful to them. And it gives them permission to suck until they can figure it out.
Yeah. I think even particularly with clowning, more than acting or really any other circus form, you won't really know until you're in front of an audience. No amount of sitting in a studio is going to get you a good read on how it's going.
Exactly. On Big Apple Circus, Michael Christensen and Jeff Gordon and I would Michael termed it noodle. We would noodle these ideas around, and then we had to get it up on its feet sooner than later, because we could just sit there laughing our asses off trying to come up with material, but eventually you got to get it on its feet. And in the early days of Big Apple Circus, and this did absolutely change, it was much looser. This is before it really took on a branding and a more of a Broadway look and a Broadway feel and a more formal thing. It was very loose, and so we could throw things in basically any time. And it was more of a living art form way, way, way back at that time, and Paul Binder, you know, encouraged it. Mm-hmm. I'm lost. What were we talking about?
We're talking about what happened after the Paris Festival.
Yes. Well, okay, so what happened after that? I did stand-up for a little while. I tried some acting for a little while. And then I saw the Big Apple Circus in New York at Lincoln Center, and I said, how else am I going to get to Lincoln Center? Because I don't really do opera or ballet, or I'm not symphonic in any way. And this is so strange, but the magician, he was a very famous magician, Doug Henning, was in the audience. And I said to myself, I want to appear in front of Doug Henning. I want stars to be able to see me, so I'm going to try to become part of the Big Apple Circus. It's kind of an odd way in, but I knocked on Paul Binder's door and said, I'd really like to be a part of this. He had happened to see me on Ringling, where what I did that seemed to stand out to him was, as grandma, I rode my skateboard holding a very large box of popcorn into a hockey wall at Madison Square Garden, which caused me to throw popcorn. And he remembered that. And he remembered me, which is remarkable considering there are 28, you know, clowns that I was working with at the time. The actual audition was for a corporate gig that the Big Apple was doing quite a few of at that time. And what I recall very clearly, and Paul will probably tell the story differently, is Jimmy Tinsman and I went up to his apartment in New York, and he was watching a New York Giants football game, avid fan, and there was a timeout, and he said, okay, and he looked over at us, and we had about a minute or two to do this routine that we had done on Ringling, this ventriloquist and dummy act in which I was the dummy, and when play resumed, he just went back and watched the TV. And I figured, okay, I didn't get this gig, but this was interesting. But I got the gig. But I started off doing corporate gigs with Big Apple. The first one was in a 5-star hotel in Acapulco, Mexico. And as I like to say, it was downhill from there. And we did a few of these things. And in a way, that was my audition for Big Apple Circus. And Grandma was a complete throw-in. It was not part of the gig. It was this ventriloquist and dummy act that they really wanted, that Paul really wanted. And I said, well, would it be okay if I do this grandma thing, maybe meeting and greeting people as they were coming in? And then when I had the opportunity and got the offer to go on to Big Apple Circus's spring and summer tour of 1982, grandma was a part of the deal. But at the time, it was, I think it was 8 weeks in the summer and 4 weeks at Lincoln Center. But it was so much damn fun that we planned our entire year around being available for those periods of time.
Did Ringling not have any kind of, don't take our clown character moment in that process? Or was it always yours?
It was always mine. They did change their contract. And when I finally did register the name and the character, I had to research that and go back and look at my old Ringling contracts. And they did not own the character. But I do believe that, you know, that has changed.
They've learned their lesson after the success of Grandma.
We let that one get away.
I had a significant experience, by the way, the first time I left Ringling. And I did go back, by the way, for about a year and a half. But the first time I left Ringling was when I was being invited to go to Monte Carlo, this, you know, this very big deal. And I did want to come back to Ringling for my fourth season. And I had a conversation with the producer, Kenneth Feld, and I said, well, you know, I'd like a stateroom, which is, I was living in a 3-foot by 6-foot, obviously very small room, and I wanted to go to a 6 by 6.
On a train.
Which I thought I was earning, because I was being sent to, you know, the Academy Awards of Circus. And he basically said, listen, no. And when, you know, whether you're here next, we'd like to have you, Barry, but whether you're here next year or not, we're going to have 28 clowns on the greatest show on earth. So do you want the gig? And I said, no. And I walked.
What year did you go back?
So only 6 months later, I moved to a guy I went to clown college with who's phenomenally talented, Dick Monday, who's a founder of the New York Goofs. Dick and I had such a great time when we went to clown college together. We performed together. Then he went on to the blue unit. I went on to the red unit. So after I left Ringling, he and I decided, he was working at SeaWorld as an MC. We wanted to do comedy together, and we would try to figure something out. So essentially, I moved to Orlando, not knowing what I would do for a real job. My real job was one of my favorite jobs ever, which was at the now defunct Circus World in Haines City, Florida. It's probably 10 miles from Disney World. And it was a one-ring circus, not in a tent, but in a building with a live band and real production values. And I had such a great time in this situation. This is my second time performing in a one-ring circus. And they kind of gave me carte blanche, which was so fantastic, to develop more material. And the problem is, it's Orlando, Florida in the summer, and part of the time you had to do these walk-around things outdoors, and you had to participate in these parades. And I was melting. I don't do well with heat, and Grandma wears a wig. I didn't have an afro with baby powder. I actually bought a wig. And I couldn't take it anymore, and I called the producers of Ringling, and I said, I would like to come back. And they offered me the red show, the blue show, and I went this time to the blue show to experience that. And I was there for about a year and a half, and I was offered a film. This is why I left Ringling. I was offered a travelogue film. The film was, talk about niche, filmmaking. This film was being made to attract drum and bugle corps groups from around the United States to come to Orlando to compete or do shows there. So this company was hired and paid by SeaWorld and Disney World and Circus World and the other attractions that were in the area to try to draw these drum and bugle corps. So I had a 3-day film that was offered to me, very exciting. And I asked permission to go for 3 days. Can you please let me go? And they said, absolutely not. And I thought that was unreasonable. Now I realize that's not true. It was completely reasonable. I was under contract. Kenneth Feld said, give it 3 more weeks. If you still want to go, I'll let you go. I'll let you out of your contract. So 3 weeks came, and I knew what the answer was going to be, but I stayed with the show for 3 weeks, and that was it. As I was leaving, I told nobody, which is not an easy secret to keep, but I sold my steamer trunk, and then I sold all my props and all the thing, and I was essentially living out in Clown Alley a white kitchen garbage bag. So I would take my costume and makeup and put it in the kitchen garbage bag for the last couple of towns. And I had no trunk anymore. And then at the final show, I didn't say goodbye even at that point. Basically picked up the garbage bag and left. I did the 3 days on this film. At the end of 3 days, I realized I was the biggest idiot in the world, because now I'm unemployed. And my soon-to-be wife was still working on Ringling, and I missed her, you know, terribly. And that it just was incredibly stupid. But I did a 3-day film shoot, which to me was something I just really couldn't pass up.
So you were with Big Apple for 25 years?
I like to say only 25 years, yes. Yeah.
But I mean, you are still vividly in my memory as a kid going to Big Apple Circus because I'm from Boston. And I think I read an article where it was like you made over, was it like 9 million people laugh over or more over all that time? It was like a New York Times article. It was like, after 25 years, Grandma has made over this many people laugh. Like, I was one of them.
Yeah, Boston, by the way, was very special to me, not only for Emerson, but doing stand-up and living there. And I considered it my second home. And the audiences in Boston were absolutely fantastic to Grandma. And I hope to go back there at some point with something. I don't know what. I keep wanting to come to Broadway with, I don't know what the hell it's going to be, but that is still in my mind something that I would like to do. But I got sidetracked. What the hell were we talking about?
Sort of about sort of the performing with Big Apple. But I was wondering if you could talk about the differences going from playing an arena to playing an intimate tent show, and sort of how that affects you clowning and the way you approach the role.
I was so in love with the beauty and the band and the lights and the sound and the intimacy of Big Apple Circus and the theater in the round, the intimate theater in the roundness to it. As I mentioned earlier, the little things that I did in the seats on Ringling translated very, very well to the One Ring setting. And I was working with really fantastic people who, as collaborators and co-writers, brought out an awful lot of neat stuff with the character. And for the first time, the character felt like Paul's attitude when he founded the Big Apple Circus and when he presented it as ringmaster was, this is my living room, welcome to it, be comfortable. And it was a very comfortable place for Grandma to live for all those years. What I missed about the three-ring circus was, I'm a big sports fan, to play Madison Square Garden just as a little clown, and to play the Boston Garden and to play, you know, these phenomenal arenas. The energy of making that many people laugh is very addictive. And I actually, after doing a lot of Big Apple Circus, I went back to arena shows with the Royal Hannaford Circus and did three ring circus shows. And when I hit, and it didn't happen immediately, but when I hit, to make 20,000 people laugh is tremendously addictive. To go from that to the intimacy of Big Apple Circus, each one has its own charm. And I still to this day prefer the intimacy, but you cannot match the energy of succeeding in front of 20,000 people. And I love to do that. And to this day, I still do big three ring circus dates, as well as one ring circus dates in buildings and lots of tented circuses. The one I'm doing right now is a 3,500 seat theater that they install a ring in, kind of in the middle, in Porto, Portugal. That is where I am right now.
So what are the audiences like? You mentioned a little bit at the beginning.
The audiences here are so generous and spoiling the hell out of me. It is such a pleasure to show up for work, and it's just a great atmosphere. These people love the circus. It's a big tradition here at Christmas, and I'm in love with this place. There's just something about Porto, which I have never been to. It's the second largest city in Portugal. There's just something very charming. The food is amazing. The people are amazing, but the quality of laughs, it's something very special. And it's really hard to describe the quality of a laugh as compared to just getting, you know, a big laugh. There is a warmth to it. There is a sophistication at times to it. I'm just going to get tongue-tied trying to describe what I mean. But when I show up and I work, they are sitting at the edge of their seat, very, very willing. And I have certainly worked in many places, including New York, and I'm not saying all the time by any means, but you would get some New York audiences which would be so sophisticated and have seen so much that it's like, what do you got, kid? You know, we've seen it all. Here in Portugal, they've probably seen it all, but they still come to the show with that childlike enthusiasm and this tremendous love for it. I think American circus, and we're not talking contemporary, but traditional circus is really aimed toward children. And, you know, we still hear, because I do a lot of work in the U.S., we still hear that, yeah, well, my kids are grown, so I don't really go to the circus anymore. And I always try to argue with that, that, you know, well, you get it much more than your kids ever possibly could. They get it on a certain level, but, you know, you understand what the effort really is and the sweat and what it took to, you know, turn in a performance this, you know, these days. So I have a theory about working in Europe. I'm probably wrong, and I discussed this with a lot of people, that the audience generally consists of people who were brought up to appreciate the arts in a way different than in the United States. And I'm not saying that people don't appreciate it, nor do they not teach their children to respect artists, but I think it's more ingrained in Europe, and that is a generalization. Please feel free to slap me if I'm completely
I would say the same. I saw, I'm going to forget his name, but somebody who was a clown in the last 3 or 4 years of Big Apple, do a number of Big Apple, and it went over okay. Like, I've seen play better, and I've seen stuff do worse. It was sort of in the middle ground. And then about 6 months later, I saw him do Knie, the exact same act, and the audience was so much more into it. And also, because the audience was so much more into it, he was really, like, vibing off of their energy, which made him even better. And it entirely, there's nothing different about what he was doing, at least in the first 2 minutes. Like, it was the exact same thing I had seen in New York. And just by virtue of the audience being different, it changes him as well as a performer.
Absolutely. I mean, we feed them, they feed us. That's the joy, especially in a one-ring circus where they're surrounding you. You feed the audience and they, you know, it comes back to you, and it's the cycle of love and communication. Paul Binder pointed out to me something really interesting, which I never thought about, which is people who are sitting on one side of the circus in a one-ring circus are also looking at the people opposite to them, and they're being fed by that information, and they're hearing the reaction, you know, coming to them. It's really interesting to me.
It is. It matters a lot for comedy. One of the things that I was talking to Spencer Novick about, who you might know, is a New York, local New York clown who was in Vegas for a while, was about spaces. So, for example, the Tohu, which is in Canada, for those who haven't been there, is a circus theater next to the Cirque du Soleil building. It's a super high roof, and it sort of prevents the audience from hearing one another clown. Oh. And sort of how that affects just general performance in the space. You're only, nothing else changing other than your ability to hear the person 4 or 5 feet away from you. Because it suddenly makes it much more like theater in a way where it's much more silent versus old school circus, where you're even allowed to sort of talk while you're watching an act. If you're like, oh my God, look how amazing that is, or pass the popcorn, which, you know, on Broadway, for example, would be, you know, a sin.
I would slap someone.
Yeah.
Right.
Stop talking.
Nobody's on their cell phone on Broadway, but they are in the circus.
Yes.
You can see a lot of those glowing faces at the circus. It's a bad sign, but okay.
And glowing toys as well.
That's really interesting. I wonder if comedy is incredibly difficult in that circumstance, or it's just different. It still works, but it's different.
Yeah.
The thing here in Porto is there's something about the acoustics where they do feed off each other. And there are people that are in the fourth balcony. I mean, they are so far up there, but they're looking right down on you. So the energy is, mm-hmm. you know, you're getting it from all sides, basically.
What made you decide to hang up your Big Apple hat?
I realized I had done everything I could possibly do, and it was going to become a thing to do for money, meaning I was very happy with the living that I made on Big Apple, but I did it because I really absolutely loved it, and I enjoyed it more than ever, which is something I hadn't anticipated this late in my life, that I would love it more than ever. But there was nothing really more that I thought I could achieve. I had really written an enormous amount of material, had worked with some of the best people in the entire business, in the entire world. And so what else was there left for me to do. And I really longed to do winter circus in Europe. It's something that I was not able to do because I was always at Lincoln Center, which, by the way, is probably the premier winter circus date, which is not occurring this year, as you know. But it's one that people from all over the world, you know, have wanted to do. They didn't particularly necessarily want to go on tour with Big Apple, but that date in, you know, in the heart of New York City is something that's still very, very big, I think.
Well, we sad this year to not see the tent at Lincoln Center. And we had Paul actually on our podcast right before when they were doing the fundraising, the final fundraising to try to save it.
Right.
And I'm still surprised that no one stepped in just to save it. But
well, that's a whole story there. And I think a lot of people have a lot of opinions, but I will tell you this. Over the years, an awful lot of people did save the circus. And it just got to a point where so many people had stepped up and were not able to anymore. Maybe they weren't willing to for one reason or another. But that fundraiser discounted all of the incredible behind-the-scenes donations that were done. They kept the circus going for, you know, the last several years. And I'm not saying it's an insult, but I think we can never forget that that was going on. It's just suddenly there was a fundraiser. It was public for the first time, saved the circus. And, you know, wow, there's got to be some millionaire out there that should be stepping up. And to me, that's a horrible business plan. And it's unfortunate that people didn't step up. But I will say this. I will probably be chastised for it. The circus needed to close in order to possibly come back to life. Mm-hmm. So it's declared bankruptcy, and
hopefully someone will buy it and, you know, and reinvigorate the Big Apple Circus.
It's likely, in my opinion, because there's a huge value, and just in terms of show business, there's a huge value to that Lincoln Center contract. Those 10 to 12 weeks, you know, in the heart of New York, I have a feeling that that will occur again, and don't be surprised if it's this.
Well, people next feel year. The absence of it now. You know, like I know a few people have come up to me and said, "What else can I see now that Big Apple's not going to be here this winter?" Because I always go see the Big Apple Circus every Christmas with my family. Yeah. What should I go see? I'm like, Paramore.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the only other circus in, you know, traditional of that scale in town, and that's, you know, not really in a tent, and, you know, it's a Broadway show.
Yeah.
But so then you now live in Sweden.
No. Oh. I left about a year ago.
Oh, okay. So
and
you have to update your website.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, that's a great idea.
It's like Barry currently lives in Sweden.
That didn't work out. I moved in December, and now I have a storage area in New Jersey. I have no actual place, and I have essentially been on tour since February, and I keep extending how long this tour is going to go. And at this point, I will probably remain on tour until April. So that's something like 14 months of not having my favorite place to hang out in and DirecTV to watch my sports. So I've been Airbnb-ing it whenever I, you know, need to do something that doesn't involve a gig. Mm-hmm. It's a very strange life, but apparently a lot of people are doing this, you know, do not have roots like they used to, because there is this kind of Uber world out there, where you don't need a car, you don't need a house, but it's driving me a little crazy.
Are there any companies or kinds of shows on your bucket list that you really, really want to do you haven't had the chance to do yet?
Cirque du Verre Bouglione in Paris, the most beautiful jewel box of a circus in the entire world. And I don't believe I will be able to check that off my bucket list. Broadway is number one. And if I were suddenly without work and desperate, I would probably get on that project, but I keep taking gigs, and those gigs take a lot of energy, and I need the extraordinary effort to really go do that as well as just doing my gig. But for instance, tomorrow we're doing four shows, so, but I mean, the only time I appeared on a Broadway stage, it was a dark night and it was a charity event. Does it count? I don't think so.
What house was it?
I walked into the ring at Cirque du Verre Bouglione in Paris to give the Big Apple Prize, the Big Apple Circus Prize, representing Big Apple Circus, because they would give prizes at, I'll never pronounce this right, the Cirque de Demain, which is the Stars of Tomorrow Circus Festival, which doesn't actually appear there anymore. But does that count that I, you know, appeared at Cirque du Verre Bouglione? No. But somebody said something liberating to me. I said, well, gee, I've marked off almost everything. Now what? And they said, now you get to enjoy, because you don't have to find a way to get those gigs in so you can check it off your bucket list. You can just do whatever the hell you want. And that basically is what I've been doing. And I've been really fortunate to be able to do what I love. I'm still waiting to have 10 gigs offered to me so that I could just pick the best one. I really thought like 30, 40 years ago that that's going to happen. If you just stay with it and you master the art, which I still haven't, that should be what happens. And it's never, ever happened. So, oh well.
I'll just create 10 shows and offer you them all at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I have turned down gigs because I had another gig, but I'm just saying I haven't, like, I will lay out all these wonderful offers, and that one's got that. That's in Hawaii. That one pays $40 million. I'll take the Hawaii, you know, whatever. And I like to say that I'm, you know, I'm proud to say I'm working on my second million, because the first million ain't happening.
That's I like that line.
Feel so free.
We usually wrap up the podcast always asking the same series of questions to our guests. And the first that we usually ask is, has there been a piece of advice, good or bad, that has stuck with you throughout your career and affected like your thought process?
Oh boy. Particular advice, that's a tough one. I think Lou Jacobs, when I first started, we all asked the master, what's funny? And his answer always was, if they laugh, it's funny. And if they don't laugh, it ain't funny. And that's incredibly irritating when you're young. And it's incredibly true to this day that that is the proof of what is funny and what is not. But that comes in many forms, that answer. And I think I'll stick with that, or otherwise it'll be an hour.
is there a show or a movie that you would recommend to somebody who is a aspiring clown or circus performer that you think you would recommend and has been influential for you?
I would say you have to watch Chaplin, you have to watch Keaton, and you must watch the Marx Brothers, maybe early Jim Carrey, Ernie Kovacs, if you can find video on Ernie Kovacs, who was a physical clown in the very early days of television and did some remarkable sight gags. And go out and watch anything and everything. It all counts. It all adds up. I tell people that I read the New York Times business section, because you never know what you might pick up in that situation. You might be ahead of a trend that has not peaked at this point, but there might be information there. So look for information everywhere. And YouTube is, you know, it's the greatest thing in the world for people looking to research and be inspired.
Oh, sorry. Now I had another question I wanted to ask you beforehand, but is not part of these series of questions.
Go for it.
Can you talk about when you would pick songs for your lip sync numbers, how your song selection process goes?
Sometimes Josh is a big lip sync fan. I will listen to a song and the hair on the back of my neck, when I used to have hair, would stand up, and I would go, there is something here. And it took me over. And it made me create a piece around it. When I was listening to Unforgettable, the duet with Nat King Cole and Natalie Cole, it just overwhelmed me. And I said, there is something huge here. I don't know what it is, but it would inform me. It would give me enough passion behind it that I would create a piece based on it. And something very, very popular I would ask my kids about. I say, what is huge right now? Because I hate to say it. When I turn on the radio, it's sports radio. I can just listen to sports radio jabbering about the most inane, stupid junk. But my kids fortunately listen to music. And so I would say, what's really peaking? Who is a huge artist right now? And sometimes they would give me a great idea and I would do it and people would go crazy. One of my biggest successes for a lip sync was Dreamgirls on Broadway. The showstopper at the end of the first half was, I'm telling you I'm not going. And I heard it and I went, this is unbelievable. And I'm going to do something with this. And the audience went absolutely crazy for it. Now, on Broadway, she was getting, I don't know, 5 or 10 minute standing ovations, stopped the show. I came fairly close to stopping the show with this thing. But, it informs me. It says something to me. It inspires the hell out of me. Because I know it has to. Otherwise, after 300 shows, I'm going to want to shoot myself.
So, do you want to ask the last question?
Sure. The last question is, who do you think would be a good guest to interview next?
Who would be a good guest to interview next?
Kind of rhymes.
That's a fantastic question. Have you had Bill Irwin?
We've not had Bill Irwin.
No, but he's
yet.
On our list.
Okay. I'll give you a very interesting choice. It's an American clown who's never performed in America. He works in Germany. He does theater. He did Roncalli. He sells out theater shows. He's an incredibly talented guy because he does stand up, which is so weird. He does stand up in English, in Germany. Half his show, and half his show is physical bits. And his name is Peter Shub, Shub. And he's absolutely one of the most interesting people there are. Fascinating interview, probably. Teaches master classes to Cirque du Soleil units in Europe and is a very, very active, very popular performing clown. I think he's in his mid-50s at this point, and I've worked with him extensively, and he'll love this because it's absolutely true. He's like the Milton Berle of clowns, which just means he's stolen everything. I think he's forgotten that he's stolen certain bits, so he believes he originated them. And that's a great – it might be a really great subject, but I would vet him on that before you – interview him. Like, make sure you can touch on that because it's probably really fascinating. But he's a great clown.
Fantastic. Barry, thank you so much for doing this interview and coming on our podcast.
Yes, thank you.
It is my pleasure, and good luck.
And that was our interview with Barry Lubin. Did that sound like a ringmaster or more like a sports announcer?
I don't know. You got to ask Paul Binder that question. So we forgot to ask Barry about this in the podcast, but he did ask us to bring it up, and I think it's very cool. Barry is kickstarting crowdfunding a project where he's going to be the first clown in history to perform on all seven continents. He's going to take a little rickety boat from the southern tip of Argentina to Antarctica to do a performance.
Oh, God.
So if you're interested in learning more about his crowdfunding and what that project is, check out the description. We have a video of him talking about it. He's in his makeup eating popcorn. And please go support Barry's crowdfunding and our crowdfunding for our new virtual reality experience.
Yes.
If you like our podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, tweet us, follow us on Instagram. And we're now putting up lots of 360 videos on YouTube. So if you follow us on YouTube, you'll get a new 360 video every couple of days.
Yeah. And have a good weekend.
Yeah. How's that for free content?